All right, now we were on slide 10. I don't think I said anything about it yet, though, right? Really? No, not about slide 10. Slide 10 is about the resting membrane potential. And every cell has a resting membrane potential. What I mean by that is not just excitable cells, neurons and muscle cells. All cells of your body have a membrane potential. So all the plasma membranes of living cells are polarized. In an excitable cell, the membrane potential can change drastically. That's what it means to be excitable. You change that voltage from its value at rest to some other value. All right? But a normal run-of-the-mill cell maintains what is called a resting membrane potential. And the resting membrane potential is brought about by the action of the sodium-potassium exchange pumps. Those are the things that actually create and maintain the gradients with respect to sodium and potassium ions. But it pumps both ions, right? They're both cations. It pumps them in opposite directions. So it's really swapping positives for positives. Although it pumps three of one ion and two of the other ion, so that does contribute to a little bit of the voltage. Voltage and potential, remember, are interchangeable terms. What we're talking about here is a voltage across the thickness of the membrane. So the pumps create the gradient, and without the gradients, there wouldn't be a resting membrane potential, but the pumps alone are really not the chief reason why there is a voltage. The main reason is that in addition to the pumps, which are proteins in the membrane working continuously, there are other membrane-bound proteins acting as non-gated potassium ion channels. Non-gated means that they're always open, so these are also called sometimes leak channels. All right, so the pumps are busy continuously spending energy in the form of ATP to stockpile potassium into the cell, because that's where the potassium ion concentration is higher. That's where potassium ions get pumped into the cell. That costs energy to do that. But then the cell allows a bunch of those to spill right back out through non-gated potassium ion channels. This is really the main reason why the voltage is created, though. The potassium ions want to diffuse back out of the cell because of the gradient that the pump established, and they're able to get back out because there are these proteins acting as non-gated potassium ion channels. There aren't leak channels for sodium, though. So you don't just undo the work you did in terms of spending energy. What you do is pump potassium ions in, and then some of those leak back out. And when those leak back out, what you're doing really is removing positives from inside the cell. And so the inside surface of the plasma membrane becomes more negative, less positive or more negative, and the outside becomes more positive or less negative. And that's why we say that the resting membrane potential has a value of negative 70 or so millivolts. Depends on the cell. All right, it's when that measurement is in reference to the inside. That's why if it's a negative value, that means the inside is more negative than the outside. So what causes it to come to a certain value? Well, the gradient is still strong because not all of those potassium ions that were pumped leak out. But imagine some of them start leaking out. The voltage gets more and more negative as more and more positives leave, right? Now, there are negative ions inside the cell that are basically locked in there because they don't have channels that they can get through. And these include not only simple anions, but also large anions like proteins with negative charges, for instance. Things that are definitely not going to come back out of the cell. They want to, though. They want to follow those positive potassiums that have just leaked out because negatives are attracted to positives. So that's why they end up gathering right at the inner surface. They're trying to follow the positives that leave, but then they get blocked by the membrane itself. All right? Well, the gradient for potassium ions is still strong, so that for that reason, potassium wants to diffuse out continuously. But eventually, the more that happens, the more the inner surface becomes negative because of these anions that want to follow but get blocked. And the more negative the interior surface gets because of all those negatively charged particles locked in the cell, the more the positive potassiums that are leaving the cell get attracted back in to the negatives that are gathered at that inner surface. So eventually there becomes an equilibrium where the tendency for them to diffuse out of the cell, potassium ions, because of their gradient, equals the tendency for them to be attracted back in by the negatives that are locked in the cell. And that happens at about negative 70 millivolts for a typical cell. That's why we call that the resting membrane potential. Okay? So that, if we're talking about an excitable cell, the resting membrane potential is there continuously when the cell is not being stimulated. Just like a normal non-excitable cell, that's just what's happening at so-called rest. Resting membrane potential is kind of a misnomer because you wouldn't have that resting membrane potential if there weren't a hell of a lot of energy being spent to power those pumps to keep that potential there. So it's not that the cell is doing nothing at rest, spending a lot of energy just maintaining that membrane potential. But it's rest compared to an action potential or a local potential, as we'll discuss in a minute. All right, slide 11. When you have an excitable cell that you want to excite into making an action potential, as we talked about before, that requires changing the voltage of the membrane from what it is at rest, negative 70 millivolts or so, to whatever the value is for the threshold potential, right? Unless you reach that threshold potential, you're not going to get an action potential. And that threshold potential is less negative. It's closer to zero, typically about negative 55 millivolts. So on a graph of voltage versus time, it would be above the resting value. You have to get that trace of voltage to go upward in the graph until it reaches threshold. All right, now that is caused, that change in voltage from its value at rest is caused by what is called a local potential. Local potentials are also called graded potentials because they can vary in their magnitude. In other words, there are strong local potentials and there are weaker local potentials, unlike action potentials, which all have the same strength. Remember I said that action potentials are all or none. Okay, so and they're also called local potentials because they're occurring just in one little piece of the membrane, not the entire membrane of the cell. So this is just in one little region. These local potentials, though, which are changes in voltage from what the value is at rest, are caused by flux or flow of ions through the membrane. Well, how do you get ions to be able to go through the membrane all of a sudden? By opening up gated channels. Okay, so there are different kinds of channels, not only because there are different kinds of ions, there are sodium channels, there are chloride channels, there are potassium channels, and so on, but also there are different kinds of gated channels on the basis of what it is that opens the channels. We talked about voltage-gated channels, we talked about ligand-gated channels. There are also channels that are opened up at certain temperatures or by being mechanically stimulated, by being deformed somehow. If you press on them, they'll open up. So there's different ways to trigger the opening of a channel. But if that happens, and if there is a gradient already in place for that type of ion, the ions will flow by diffusion through that channel. And since they're ions and therefore are carrying charge, that means you are going to disturb whatever the voltage is. You're going to perturb the voltage. You're going to change its value because you're moving charges around. And a charge that was on one side is now going to be on the other side. That's going to change what the voltage is. All right? This figure 11 shows you the operation of a ligand-gated ion channel. And it's ligand-gated because the thing that opens up the gate is the presence of some ligand that binds to a receptor site on that channel. The channel is a protein. It's acting simultaneously as a ligand receptor and as an ion channel. If that ligand is present and it binds, the shape change that it causes opens up the gate so that that particular kind of ion that channel is specific for will flow through down its gradient, either into the cell or out of the cell, depending on what the direction of the gradient is, which depends on what type of ion it is. In this case, it's a sodium ion channel, which are typically used in stimulatory local potentials. Okay? This is exactly what we talked about in the previous chapter at the neuromuscular junction between a motor neuron and a skeletal myofiber. Right? The ligand in that example was acetylcholine released from the neuron. It acted as a ligand bound to the receptor on the motor end plate. Those ligand receptors served as ligand-gated sodium ion channels. That opened up the channel, allowed sodium to flow into the cell because sodium is in a higher concentration in the extracellular fluid compared to the intracellular fluid. And since sodium is a cation, that means when the channel is opened, you're going to import positives into the cell. That's going to make the interior less negative, more positive. So that would cause an upswing in the voltage trace. Right? That would be an example of a local potential that's being caused. In just that little area of the plasma membrane, it's becoming less negative. It's going up towards zero. In other words, it's going toward the threshold value, whatever that is. And if it gets all the way up to threshold, in other words, if enough sodium ions flow in that it brings the voltage up to the value of threshold, then you'll have an action potential, which involves still other kinds of ion channels, not these ones. All right. Once you have ions flowing into or out of the cell, though, they can also then diffuse along the length of the cell. And a flow of charges is called a current. Right? A voltage is a separation of charges. It's a gradient. A current, electrically, is the flow of charge. In an AC circuit in a house, electricity, in other words, the current is just electrons along a wire. In cells, it's not single electrons. It's charged particles, ions, which are much bigger than electrons. But the result is the same. You're moving charges around. And so there's current that flows along the length of a neuron. All right. Now, at the dendrites, you have these gated ion channels, not necessarily ligand-gated, but often ligand-gated. Any kind of gated channel which will respond to some sort of stimulus, if those gates open, and if it's a sodium ion channel, for instance, then that's going to cause a local potential that is depolarizing. It's depolarizing because the resting membrane potential is a polar situation, right? It's called polar because you have one side of the membrane that's positive and one side that's negative. If you bring that closer to zero, you're depolarizing it because being exactly at zero would mean there is no charge difference through the membrane and it is not polar. So going up, an upswing in the trace from resting is a depolarization. All right? That's what happens at dendrites. Local potentials. Now, local potentials, because of their current, travel some distance from where they are created originally. But they dissipate over distance, so they get weaker and weaker the farther from the point of stimulus they get. If enough of these local potentials or a strong enough local potential causes enough current at the soma, or the cell body of the neuron, For the trigger zone, which is the specific part of the plasma membrane of the neuron right where the axon starts, to come to threshold, then you'll get an action potential. The trigger zone is special because it has a very high density of voltage-gated sodium and potassium ion channels. Okay? Those are two separate channels. Voltage-gated sodium ion channels, voltage-gated potassium ion channels are the ones that are involved in creating action potentials. You don't have many of those in the dendrites. You have a lot of them at the trigger zone. So if the local potentials that get created at the dendrites are sufficient to bring the trigger zone up to threshold voltage, then the voltage-gated sodium ion channels and voltage-gated potassium ion channels at the trigger zone will open up and create an action potential. And that action potential will create another action potential right next to it, and so on down the whole length of the axon. In other words, a nerve signal will be created in the form of a chain reaction of action potentials. All right, that's the basis of how a neuron fires. Let's compare in slide 12 local potentials and action potentials. I've already done a little bit of this comparison. Notice that local potentials are produced by gated channels. That's what I already said. They are gated channels that are usually not voltage gated, but they could be. It could be any kind of gated channel. Often they are ligand gated. Whereas action potentials are produced only by voltage gated ion channels, and specifically at the trigger zone. Local potentials I discussed in terms of a depolarizing potential, one that brings it up in the graph, but there can also be local potentials that make the plasma membrane even more negative inside. So local potentials can go in either direction. They can be either polarizing, upward swing, or depolarizing, upward swing, or hyperpolarizing, downward swing. Hyperpolarizing because they're making it even more polar than it was at rest. They're making it more negative inside. In other words, they're bringing it even farther away from threshold, so it makes it less likely that the neuron would produce an action potential. They are graded, as I mentioned. That means that they can vary in magnitude. There can be big ones and small ones, unlike an action potential. All action potentials are the same size. Either you get an action potential that is full size, or you don't get one at all. That's what all or none means. Reversible means that they dissipate and in distance and in time. So the voltage will go up a little bit, but then a moment later it'll come back to resting membrane potential. Whereas in an action potential, it is not irreversible. When you produce that first action potential, you're definitely going to get the second one right next to it, definitely get the next one right next to that, and so on. So you don't just get a few action potentials and it stops midway down the axon. If you create that first one, it's definitely going to reach the end. Local, as I said, means that it's only occurring on a tiny bit of membrane, not simultaneously over the entire neuron. And the local potentials are occurring at the dendrite end of the neuron, whereas the action potentials start at the axon and then get continued to be created from there on. And decremental means what I've already said, I just didn't use that word, that the farther you get away from that place where the ions flow to create the local potential, the weaker the voltage get, the weaker the change in voltage gets. Now let's look at an action potential graph, actually two graphs in slide 13. These are really the same graph, but the how the graph really should look is in B. You just don't see very much detail because of the time is not distorted on B. If we distort the time so that we can stretch certain parts out so we can see it and squeeze other parts so they fit on the graph, you have the graph that you see in A. So notice that at rest, it's about negative 70 millivolts. Nothing's happening with respect to any stimulus. The cell is just busy using its pumps to maintain its resting membrane potential. Then a stimulus is applied, meaning that could just mean your intention to move a muscle, for instance. But whatever the stimulus is, it's an event that causes a local potential. And if it's going to be an event that has a chance of making an action potential occur, then it specifically has to cause a depolarizing potential because you have to get it to swing up, not down. Right? Otherwise, you would never get to threshold. So, number one here on the graph points to the creation of a graded local potential, and in this case, a depolarizing potential. So, for instance, like we saw in the example, sodium ions flowing into the cell because gated sodium ion channels get opened in response to that stimulus. In this case, enough ion channels get opened so that there's enough ion flow for there to be enough of a change in membrane potential for it to actually get up to threshold. Right where you see threshold, the red line crossing the threshold, that's the end of the local potential and the beginning of the action potential. So the action potential itself is the entire red trace from where number two is all the way to where it gets back to resting membrane potential between 6 and 7. And the action potential itself is broken into segments in time. There is the depolarization phase, the steep upswing on the graph, and that's called depolarization phase because you're going from negative to less negative in that chance. Notice that it actually crosses zero, but even though it crosses zero and gets more positive, which is another form of polarization, we call that upswing the depolarization phase. It peaks at some positive value, slightly positive value, and then undergoes the repolarization phase when it comes back down to being polarized like it was when it was at rest to begin with. So the downswing is the repolarization phase. And the hyperpolarization phase refers to the fact that it actually doesn't come just down to resting value. It overshoots resting and becomes even more negative than it was before the action potential happened, and it has to recover from that and come back up slightly just to get to resting membrane potential again. Once it actually gets back to resting membrane potential after the hyperpolarization, then that action potential is done. And the cell might undergo another action potential right at that same spot. Maybe not. It depends on what's happening upstream. Let's look at what's happening at the molecular level in slide 14. This, notice that the graph, little inset, shows you which part of the graph that we just looked at is being illustrated in each of these four parts. So sodium-potassium pumps are busy maintaining the resting membrane potential along with the leak channels allowing for efflux of potassium ions. That's what's causing the resting membrane potential in number one. Two, we have sodium ion channels opening up because of the stimulus. These are the gated sodium ion channels that could be either ligand gated or thermally gated, whatever. But the influx of sodium flow into the cell means that you're bringing positives into the cell. That's going to cause an upswing in the trace. That's why it's a depolarizing potential. This is a local potential, not an action potential. And if it's sufficient to get it to threshold, which it is in this case, then entirely different kinds of sodium ion channels, voltage-gated sodium ion channels, take over because that threshold is a voltage. It's the special voltage that acts as the key to open up the gates of voltage-gated sodium ion channels. Those are different proteins compared to the proteins that just opened in the previous step. Those were sodium ion channels as well, but not the ones that are involved in the action potential. Okay, they just get up to the threshold so that the voltage-gated sodium ion channels take over and create the action potential. There are two ion channels involved, though, as I said, voltage-gated sodium ion channels and voltage-gated potassium ion channels. When the threshold is met, both of these start to open. But importantly, sodium ion channels are much more quick to open up. They spring right open. Potassium ion channels start to open up at the same time, but it takes them a while before they're open enough for potassium to actually flow through them. All right? If that weren't the case, then you'd have sodium and potassium flowing in opposite directions, basically just swapping a positive for a positive, and you wouldn't have a change in voltage. But since the sodium ion channels open right up immediately, that means all that's flowing is sodium ions down their gradient, which means into the cell from the extracellular fluid. That's bringing even more positives that came in already through the other channels Many more of these open up, and so you have a steep rise in the voltage. That's the depolarization phase of the action potential. Now, sodium ion, voltage-gated sodium ion channels are actually doubly gated. There's two voltages that act as switches on them. The first voltage, which is the threshold voltage, opens up what we call the activation gate. And it has another gate called an inactivation gate that is, at this time, was already open. But you have to have both gates open, of course. You know, think of it like a tunnel. If there's a gate on either end, this is not really how they're formed, but if you have a tunnel with a gate at either end, you're not going to get all the way through the tunnel unless both gates are open, right? So it starts with inactivation gates open, activation gates closed. That threshold voltage opens up the second gate, the activation gate, and that's why now you have sodium ions coming through it into the cell. That causes the steep rise. But as the more sodium ions come in, the more the voltage increases, right? It's becoming a higher and higher voltage. Well, there's a second higher voltage that actually closes the inactivation gates. All right? The ones that were open already, they now close. And so even though now the activation gates are still open because you're above threshold, the inactivation gates close, and that prevents more sodium ions from entering. Because otherwise, this would just be a chain reaction that would get out of control, right? This is how sodium ion channels turn themselves off. So, at the peak of the trace of the action potential, that slightly positive voltage that's attained, that's what closes the inactivation gate. So, that in itself stops further diffusion of sodium. So, that means the cell is no longer getting more positive, right? But that doesn't mean that it's going to get negative on its own. That just means it's going to stop getting positive. What makes it then get more negative by going back down in the trace is that by now enough time has elapsed for the comparatively slow to open potassium ion channels have now all fully opened, and potassium is now going to flow down its own gradient, which is in the opposite direction. Potassium is now going to leave the cell through these voltage-gated potassium ion channels. That means you're now removing a bunch of positives from the inside of the cell. That's going to bring it back to a negative value. Okay? So, sodium ions flow first, and then potassium ions flow second, and they undo each other, and that's why the trace goes up first, and then back down. Yeah? This depends on the cell. These are good averages, but it depends on the type of cell. That's another average. But for a given cell, it's always going to be basically the same value. These don't bother even really memorizing the values because they're just averages anyway. Now, I said that these potassium ion channels are slow to open. They're also slow to close. And that's why you have the hyperpolarization. Not only does potassium flowing out of the cell cause it to come back down to resting, but because there's still some potassium flowing through these channels as they're closing, a little bit more leaks out than you really need to just to get it back to resting, and therefore it goes even more negative than resting. That's the hyperpolarization phase. But once they fully close, then it comes back to equilibrium based on what I said caused equilibrium to begin with. The leak channels for potassium. So the leak channels are totally different proteins compared to the voltage-gated potassium ion channels, right? All right, let's go to 15. Here we're looking at a single action potential trace, and notice that the action potential is only the kind of, I don't know what these colors are, ecru and mustard. That's the only part of the action potential. This part is not. This part is not. Where it's resting, that's not action potential. But the first part, the ecru part, notice that that is labeled as the absolute refractory period. Refractoriness refers to insensitivity. So if a neuron is refractory, that means it is either impossible or more difficult for a second action potential to be created in that same part of the membrane because it's already been recently stimulated. Okay? Well, absolute refractory period is just what it says. It's absolutely refractory. That means it doesn't matter how big a second stimulus would be, a second local potential that would be occurring in that same spot. Doesn't matter how big it is, it's not going to create a second action potential. And that's explained because in order for a new action potential to be created, you have to reset those gates on the sodium ion channels. You have to reset them so that the activation gate is closed and the inactivation gate is open. That doesn't happen until you get this thing back down to resting potential. And that's why the absolute refractory period ends when you get back to resting. But you overshoot resting, remember, in hyperpolarization. So this hyperpolarization phase, until you get rid of the overshoot and go back up to just membrane resting potential, that is called the relative refractory period. It's not absolute because it is possible to have another action potential created during that time, but it's more difficult than it was originally when you were at resting membrane potential. And that makes sense, right? It's more negative than it is at rest, so it's going to take an even bigger depolarizing potential to get it up to threshold. You're farther away from threshold here than you were originally. And so, yes, it's possible for another action potential to be created, but it has to be a bigger stimulus that's going to cause it, because it has to be a bigger depolarizing potential to get you to threshold. Now, the reason the refractory period is important is because you want to be able to space these action potentials out from each other. A neuron has a frequency of action potentials. That's how it encodes the magnitude of the stimulus. Since action potentials are all or none, they're all the same size, there's no such thing as a bigger action potential and a smaller action potential. So if you need to tell the other thing at the other end of the neuron that it was a strong stimulus, you can't do that with just an action potential by itself. They're all the same size. You know, to tell your brain that you're getting hit by a hammer rather than just being caressed, that's a different size stimulus, right? Well, you don't encode that with different size action potentials. They're all the same size. You encode that with a greater frequency. So how you space them out is important. That's one aspect of the refractory period. Another, though, is that it's important for an action potential to be created at one end, the axon hillock, where it connects to the body, and go in one direction toward the presynaptic terminals, or the bulbs that we were talking about. I mean, the synaptic knobs that we were talking about. In other words, we don't want action potentials to echo. We don't want them to travel in the reverse direction. We want the nerve signal to travel in one direction only. Well, we can see this illustrated in slide 16. Notice that we're looking at just a little section of the length of an axon. And it's a cylinder in cartoon form. But if you think about it as a finger with a bunch of rings on it, each little ring is one circular section of that overall length, right? And so what are colored here as little stripes are these ring-like strips of membrane where action potentials can occur. An action potential occurs just in a specific place on the membrane. Well, an action potential is itself a drastic change in voltage. So when you have that huge upswing, that voltage gets felt because of the current that flows by ions moving by the next little strip of membrane. And so one action potential easily gets the next slice of membrane up to its own threshold, which is why the next action potential is created. And the next one will be created after that for the same reason. That's why it's a chain reaction. If you imagine a bunch of mouse traps laid end to end, so that the first one going off sets off the second one. As long as you have that first one going off, there's no way you're going to stop that, right? It's going to just create the snapping of additional mouse traps. All right, well, think about What would happen if you didn't have the refractory period? An action potential that's traveling toward the right in this figure, that second action potential would then stimulate the previous slice to the left again. And so the whole axon would just continuously be stimulated, and there would be action potential propagation in both directions over and over. It would keep echoing. So we want an action potential to be created at one end and travel just down the length of the axon. The reason that it doesn't echo backwards is because the action potential that's created in the second slice does not stimulate the first slice, because that first slice is still in its refractory period. And therefore, no size stimulus is sufficient to create another action potential. Not until those gates on the voltage-gated sodium ion channels get reset in that first strip can it create another action potential. And by the time that resetting occurs, the voltage change has spread away from that point. The action potentials are no longer right next door. Okay? The nerve signal is being sent some distance away by then, and therefore there isn't another action potential. There will be only another action potential in that first slice if there is a second stimulus, or if the original stimulus was so strong that it still hasn't dissipated down to the point of being below threshold. So in other words, it takes continual stimulation for additional action potentials to be created because of the refractory period. All right, now to 17. Here we're looking at action potential propagation, and propagation refers to it's additional action potentials being created, this chain reaction. Sometimes we say that action potentials travel. They don't really. One action potential is happening just at one slice, but then it creates an action potential right next to it. So what really travels is, it should more properly be called a nerve signal, which is a combination of a bunch of action potentials, one after another, all the way down the length of the axon. Sometimes we don't bother to use the correct terminology, though, so when we say an action potential travels, that's really what we mean. Okay, it's not one action potential, it's many. Well, in an unmyelinated axon, which are the ones that do not have myelin covering them, right? So, and this can happen either in the central nervous system or the peripheral nervous system. If there aren't the proper type of neuroglial cells, either oligodendrocytes in the central nervous system or Schwann cells or neurolemmocytes in the peripheral nervous system, then you'll have unmyelinated axon. In an unmyelinated axon, you're going to have a maximum number of action potentials, because that first little slice is going to stimulate the next little slice and so on all the way down the line. Well, that takes some time. If you think about this by analogy with dominoes, A nerve signal, which is many action potentials, is like the toppling of dominoes. You know, first of all, you're not going to get any toppling of dominoes unless that first one is fully toppled. If I just barely touch the domino, it might move back and forth, but if I don't get it to threshold, it's not going to actually fall, and therefore it's just going to come back to rest eventually. And the other end is not going to ever know that happened, because no domino toppled, right? But if I get it to threshold and topple that first one, it's going to topple the second one and so on down the line. In an unmyelinated axon, it's like having dominoes spaced very close together. All right? So you have to use a bunch of dominoes to do that, basically. Notice that if I space them out, I can get that message to travel with far fewer dominoes. But I can't space them out indefinitely, right? I can't space them out more than the height of a domino. Because if I do, the first one will fall and it won't touch the second one. But if it's less than the height of the domino, I can space them out and get it to topple using far fewer dominoes going the same distance to the other end. That's what myelination is analogous to. By having many myelin sheaths on the axon, there are going to be far fewer action potentials. The action potentials only occur in little non-myelinated sections between the myelin sheaths. Okay? So each little myelin sheath is a bundle of myelin created by its own neuroglial cell. And those are called the parts of the neuron, which is the sheath, remember, is a separate cell. But the part of the axon that is surrounded by the myelin sheath is called an internode. Specifically meaning between nodes, right? That makes sense because the parts between the sheaths that are not myelinated, just little bare spots, are called nodes of Ranvier, named after a dead Frenchman. And the nodes of Ranvier are where the action potentials occur in a myelinated axon. All right? Action potentials don't occur in the internodes because the myelin blocks the flow of ions. In other words, the myelin insulates the internodes, and there is no current through the membrane at those places. There is current, though, inside, longitudinal current, inside the axon itself, because when sodium ions rush in, they also diffuse down the length of the axon, right? Well, that lengthwise diffusion is actually impeded if ions are also coming in through the membrane. So if you insulate at an internode, there can be greater diffusion longitudinally toward the end of the axon, and therefore greater current. All right? Well, the current that's caused by these flow of sodiums that have come in dissipates over distance. They're not really so much that they're flowing. They're basically knocking into other sodiums and pushing them along. Not really knocking. They're repelled by each other because they're both positive. So the first one nudges the second one, which nudges the third, and so on. That's what really causes a flow of charge down the length. But it gets weaker and weaker the farther you get from the previous internode. All right? However, there is a maximum distance at which this longitudinal current is sufficient to bring the voltage-gated sodium ion channels in this next internode up to their threshold values, and therefore cause a new action potential at the next internode. And how do you suppose evolution has worked here? It has optimized it so that these internodes are about as long as they can possibly be. If they were any longer, then the current would not be enough to cause the next action potential in the next node of Ranvier. If they're shorter, then you don't get as much of an advantage because it's like using more dominoes rather than fewer. So these things are spaced out about a millimeter or so, and that's just about perfect for the next action potential to still be created. And so propagation of a nerve signal in a myelinated axon is said to be saltatory conduction. Conduction refers to the flow of the nerve signal. It can also be called saltatory propagation, but books usually call it conduction. Saltatory, though, is a word, is an adjective, right? Saltate means leap. So saltatory means in a leaping fashion. And it's called that because one action potential is created at one internode. No action potentials are created in the next node, but then a new action potential is created in the next internode. And so it seems like action potentials leap from internode to internode. That doesn't take nearly as much time for the nerve signal to reach the other end as it would if you had to create a bunch of individual action potentials the whole way. Because action potentials take some time, they reduce this longitudinal flow. That's why myelinated axons are much faster than unmyelinated axons. Okay, let's go to 18. We're looking at schematic representations of neurons here. Remember that when we use this schematic representation, the cell body or soma is just drawn as a circle. The axon is a line, and then the presynaptic terminal is either a half circle or, in this case, a triangle. So the triangle here represents the presynaptic terminal or the synaptic knobs, whatever you want to call them. We talked about synapses in the previous chapter in reference to the neuromuscular junction. That's a synapse, of course. Whenever a neuron is connecting to some downstream cell, that's a synapse. But in the nervous system, rather than at the junction between nervous and muscular system, just within the nervous system, most synapses are between neurons and other neurons. All right? And so when you have a serial arrangement, an end-to-end arrangement of neurons connected by a synapse between them, you have what is called a presynaptic neuron and a postsynaptic neuron, the one that comes before the synapse, the one that comes after. All right, so typically what happens is that the axon terminal of the presynaptic terminal will connect to dendrites on the postsynaptic neuron. All right, because remember, the dendrites are the inputs. The secondary, the downstream, the postsynaptic neuron is receiving inputs at its dendrites from the presynaptic terminal. That's a typical arrangement, but that's not the only way this can happen. Notice that there are what are called axodendritic synapses. That's what I just described. Axodendritic means that the axon from the presynaptic terminal connects to the synapses with the dendrite of the postsynaptic terminal. All right? But there are also axosomatic synapses. Some presynaptic terminals synapse directly with the soma rather than with a dendrite that connects to the soma. So that's why it's axosomatic. And there are still others that are axoaxonic synapses, meaning that the axon terminal of the presynaptic neuron synapses with the axon of the postsynaptic neuron. Axoaxonic, one axon to the other. 19. This should be a little bit familiar to you already. We're looking here at a chemical synapse. And chemical synapses are slow compared to electrical synapses. Remember, there are such things as electrical synapses. You see them in certain specialized structures, like the heart, for instance, which is what we talked about. Adjacent cardiac myofibers are joined by electrical synapses so that an action potential or the series of action potentials goes straight from one cell to the next cell through the gap junctions. Now, this is useful in the heart because when one cell in the chamber of the heart fires, you want all of them to simultaneously fire in order for it to work as a pump. It's faster as well. And so you might think, why not set up the nervous system this way? Why have a series of neurons when you could just have one long run from the beginning to wherever it goes? It would be faster if you did that, but you would lose the ability to integrate information. Remember that an important function of the nervous system is integration, which means processing the information appropriately so that the output is appropriate. So you don't necessarily want the thing to fire at the other end. It depends on what's happening upstream. And the more connections you have along the way, the greater there is a chance for integrating a lot of information for one ultimate response, one ultimate output. Okay? So that's why we have chemical synapses. It allows for integration of information. Now, chemical synapses are called chemical synapses because the first signal, a train of action potentials, results in the release of a chemical, a neurotransmitter, right? That first nerve signal is done. That happens only in the presynaptic neuron. The chemical is the neurotransmitter. And the neurotransmitter is going to cause some change in membrane potential in the postsynaptic neuron. Now, it's not necessarily going to cause a depolarizing potential. It could cause a hyperpolarizing potential. But it's going to cause some change in voltage on the postsynaptic terminal, and therefore it's going to influence how it behaves. Okay? Well, there's two major ways that we'll see pictures of, and this is one of them, in which neurotransmitters can cause changes to occur in the postsynaptic cell. One is the one you already had an example of. This is just like the neuromuscular junction, except this is a junction between two neurons, one upstream, one downstream. The reason it's the same, though, is that the ligand, which is the neurotransmitter that gets released, when it binds to its ligand receptor, that receptor, which is a protein, also serves itself as an ion channel, right? This is exactly what the neuromuscular junction was set up as. What was the neurotransmitter in that case? Acetylcholine. And when it binds to acetylcholine receptors, those receptors open up they are channels, and they open up in response to the binding of that acetylcholine, and they're channels that are specific for sodium, right? So this allows sodium to rush into the downstream cell, which in your example was a muscle. Here it would be a neuron. But by opening up directly ion channels that are ligand-gated ion channels, this is one way that a neurotransmitter can cause a local potential in the downstream cell. Which kind of ion channels get opened up, though, is going to determine whether that graded potential that's created in the postsynaptic neuron is depolarizing or hyperpolarizing. If it opens up a chloride ion channel, for instance, instead of a sodium ion channel, well, chloride, just like sodium, is in greater concentration in the extracellular fluid. But unlike sodium, it's an anion. So if you open up a chloride ion channel, chloride ions go in and you're bringing in negatives. That would make it even more negative than it was at rest. That would cause a hyperpolarizing local potential in the postsynaptic neuron. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, so it depends on what the receptor does as to what the response is. It doesn't depend on the neurotransmitter. So you shouldn't think of a neurotransmitter as always causing a certain kind of response. It depends on what the receptor for that neurotransmitter is in that situation. The same neurotransmitter can be used in different parts of the body, causing totally different effects because it binds to different receptors and therefore has different changes in the downstream cells. Okay, but that's one major possibility, when the ligand receptors are themselves ion channels. Actually, is there anything else I wanted to say about that while we were still there? No. Let's go to slide 20, and I'm not going to read this whole thing to you. I just want to point out that there are many kinds of neurotransmitters, and we continue to discover more. This is by no means an exhaustive list. This is just a small list of some important neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters, by the way, are signal molecules just like hormones are, but they're called neurotransmitters because they are not broadcast throughout the body. They're not released into the bloodstream and sent to all the cells. They operate locally. They're released just from presynaptic terminals of neurons, and their receptors are on cells that are right there at that other end of the synapse. They don't go anywhere else and have an effect. So that's what makes them neurotransmitters, not what chemical they are. You could have the same chemical operating as a hormone in one instance and a neurotransmitter in another instance. So it's not a chemical distinction, it's a functional distinction. Anyway, notice not so much the individual examples, but in italics you have four major categories of neurotransmitters. And acetylcholine, which is what we've already talked about, the only other example we've really talked about, that's in a class by itself. So there are three other major kinds, though. There are various kinds of amino acids that act as neurotransmitters. Amino acids, remember, are the building blocks of proteins, but that's not the only thing they do. Amino acids, an amino acid is an amino acid, by the way, because there's a central carbon that's connected to a hydrogen atom, an amino group, a carboxyl group, and something else. If it fills those criteria, then it is an amino acid. And some amino acids, like you see here, glutamate, aspartate, those actually operate in certain instances as neurotransmitters. Then there are monoamines. Monoamines are really just decarboxylated amino acids. So you start out with an amino acid, you strip the carboxyl off of it, which is the COOH group, and you still have the amino group on it, which it had originally, and that's why they're called monoamines. Norepinephrine and epinephrine we'll talk more about later on in other chapters. Those are important monoamines, but that's a third class. And then there are neuropeptides. Now, peptides are getting bigger than amino acids, because when you build a protein, you build it up of amino acids, and individual pairs of amino acids are hooked together by peptide bonds. That's why another name for a protein is a polypeptide. Well, these aren't as big as full-blown polypeptides, but they are multiple amino acids big, so they're bigger than all the rest of the classes. And they operate as, certain ones of those operate as neuropeptides, which are neurotransmitters. Well, you see pictures of them in slide 21. Acetylcholine in schematic form, remember, in a class by itself. Some amino acids, some monoamines, and these neuropeptides are much bigger. The individual beads of these strings are amino acids that they're made out of, threonine, leucine, phenylalanine, and so on. By the way, that one I was pointing at, beta endorphin, this is a neurotransmitter that is released in times of stress or injury a naturally occurring painkiller. You make your own painkillers, or much like a painkiller that you would take, like aspirin or some other thing. Endorphin does the same thing, but you make it on your own. All right, anyway, that was just some neurotransmitter types. Well, 22 shows you the action, we've already talked about this, shows you the action of a chemical synapse that is working so that the neurotransmitter receptor is directly an ion channel. This is what I was just talking about two slides ago. But you see a little bit more detail here. This hopefully is review for you. When the nerve signal reaches the synaptic knob, which is what you're looking at here in close-up, that change in voltage, which that last action potential is on the line, that change in voltage opens up voltage-gated calcium ion channels, because they're closed until the voltage gets high enough. That high enough voltage is that final action potential in the presynaptic neuron. They spring open, and calcium ions then flow down their gradient, diffuse, in other words. That means they go from outside to in the presynaptic cell or neuron, and it's this influx of calcium that actually causes the exocytotic release of the synaptic vesicles, or the contents of the synaptic vesicles. So even before the action potential arrived here or was created here, there were a bunch of synaptic vesicles housing a bunch of neurotransmitter molecules ready to go. They're docked at the ready. They just need the release signal. That release signal is the calcium coming in. That's what causes the neurotransmitter to spill out into the synaptic cleft. All right. Now, in this case, it's acetylcholine as the green ball that's being used. And acetylcholine receptors are themselves ion channels. So when the binding of acetylcholine happens, that means sodium ions travel into the cell, the postsynaptic neuron, and that causes a depolarizing local potential in the postsynaptic neuron, because you're bringing positives into the cell. Remember also that you have to stop this signal. If there's only one action potential, one nerve signal that's coming along from the original stimulus, You don't want to continue to stimulate the postsynaptic neuron. You want to just give it one jolt and that's it. That's why neurotransmitters can't be allowed to hang around. And remember, they're not. Acetylcholine is quickly broken down by acetylcholinesterase, an enzyme that will break it down into its two components, which are choline and acetate, acetic, the deprotonated form of acetic acid. Breaks those down, it no longer operates as a ligand. The acetic acid is everywhere in the system, so it basically just diffuses away. But the choline gets pumped back into the presynaptic terminal because it's useful stuff. Once it gets back into the presynaptic terminal, it's united with acetate that's already in there to make acetylcholine again for another round. But it's not going to be released unless another action potential is created at that synaptic bulb. Knob, I keep saying bulb. Okay, so that's one major way in which chemical signals operate. A second is shown in 23. Everything's the same up to the release of the neurotransmitter, but there are certain neurotransmitters whose receptors are actually not ion channels themselves. Instead, the neurotransmitter receptors in the postsynaptic neurons plasma membrane are transmembrane proteins that don't allow anything through them. All they do is what you would expect to happen when a ligand binds to them, which is what? They change shape. Since they're transmembrane and poke all the way through the thickness of the membrane, when they change shape, that means the shape change gets recognized on the part of that protein that's facing the interior of the cell. And therefore, that new shape that's facing the interior of the cell can interact with things inside the cell that it wouldn't be able to interact with until it changed shape. So the neurotransmitter is basically knocking on the door. It doesn't enter the cell, the neurotransmitter doesn't, but it causes something to happen inside the cell because of the shape change that it causes at the door itself, really. Okay? Well, this happens via what we call a G protein. There are G protein linked receptors. The receptor is just a receptor, but it is linked to, it has attached to it on the inner surface, what's called a G protein. And a G protein, which is represented here by the purple tic tac shaped thing, that can be either inactivated or activated. It becomes activated when the neurotransmitter binds to the receptor. The G protein is bound to the other end of the receptor before that, but when the neurotransmitter binds to it, it releases the G protein. And the release of the G protein means that it's now able to wander along the inner surface of the membrane until it interacts with something else. And that something else that it interacts with, as you see here, is in orange in the middle, is a membrane-bound enzyme called adenylate cyclase. Some books call it adenylyl cyclase. It's the same thing. Adenylate cyclase is an enzyme that's able to catalyze the conversion of ATP into cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP is called a second messenger because it's received a message from the original neurotransmitter. The neurotransmitter's job is done. Now it's carrying the message somewhere else. Cyclic AMP is called that because you take ATP, which has three phosphates strung away from the adenosine, take two of those phosphates off, and then stick that one phosphate on at a second position, so it actually forms a little ring. The phosphate is connected in two places to the adenosine. That's why it's called cyclic AMP. Anyway, cyclic AMP is the second messenger, and it gets created out of ATP only when adenylate cyclase is activated. Well, adenylate cyclase gets activated by the G protein, which doesn't get activated until the neurotransmitter binds. So this is a multi-step process, and the production of cyclic AMP is not the end goal. It's just another step in this overall process. As you see here, multiple things can occur depending on the cell and the situation. One thing that can occur, shown in 5, is that cyclic AMP can cause the binding of ligands that are already in the cell to ligand-gated sodium ion. Well, in this case, sodium, but some sort of ion channel. All right. So this really has the same effect as if the neurotransmitter itself were a sodium ion channel, but it did it in several different steps. Or the production of cyclic AMP can cause activation of certain enzymes that are in the cell that weren't activated up to this point. And so that turns them on, and suddenly the biochemical pathways that they catalyze are turned on. So it affects metabolism, in other words. Or another example would be that cyclic AMP's activation or creation causes genes to be transcribed. Genes are turned on and off. When a gene is turned on, it gets to be transcribed to make a messenger RNA, which then is used to make a protein, right? So turning on gene transcription is one possible effect of cyclic AMP as well. Now, this is a lot more complicated than it is in just the simpler case we talked about before, where the ligand just opens up an ion channel directly. And so you might think, why would this evolve? Evolution should favor simpler things. Well, it is definitely more complicated, but that has an advantage. The advantage in this signal transduction pathway, as it's called, the signal keeps getting transduced, or in other words, it gets transformed into another form. It's kind of like a relay race. The reason that signal transduction, even though it is far more complicated, is advantageous, is that it allows for drastic amplification of the signal. So you can have a profound effect just in response to a tiny, tiny number of original neurotransmitters. And that's because at each step in the process, there can be more of the next signal made for each of the original signal. If you imagine just one neurotransmitter binding, that single neurotransmitter can actually activate multiple G proteins. Each G protein itself can activate multiple adenylate cyclase enzymes, each of which itself can create multiple cyclic AMPs and so on. So by the time you get to the ultimate effect, you can have millions of molecules be affected by that original one neurotransmitter. That's called a signal transduction cascade. Okay, now to 24. Well, we've already talked about the fact that a local potential can be either depolarizing or hyperpolarizing. If we're talking about a local potential that's created in a postsynaptic neuron in response to something that's happening in the presynaptic neuron, then we call that change, that voltage change, a postsynaptic potential, or PSP. And there are two kinds of PSPs. EPSPs and IPSPs. E here stands for excitatory. An excitatory postsynaptic potential is just a depolarizing potential in the downstream neuron. In order for it to be excitatory, which means more likely for that postsynaptic neuron to fire, it has to be an upward swing, right? It has to go toward threshold. So an EPSP won't necessarily cause an action potential, but it makes it more likely because it's headed in the right direction. An inhibitory, which is what the I stands for, an inhibitory postsynaptic potential, or IPSP, is just the opposite. It's also a local graded potential in the postsynaptic neuron, but it's a hyperpolarizing local potential. For instance, chloride ion channel would open up instead of a sodium ion channel. So it becomes the membrane potential in the postsynaptic neuron becomes more negative, farther away from threshold, and therefore that postsynaptic neuron becomes even less likely than it already was to fire. Now you might think, it's not going to fire at rest anyway. Why would you make it even more negative? Well, yeah, it's not going to fire at rest, but this presynaptic neuron that we're talking about that's connected to the postsynaptic neuron is not the only presynaptic neuron connected to it. We describe it that way for simplicity, but the integrating power of the central nervous system, the way it's able to process so much information, comes from the fact that a postsynaptic neuron can have literally thousands or tens of thousands of presynaptic neurons simultaneously synapsing with that same downstream neuron. And therefore, some of those presynaptic neurons might be causing EPSPs, excitatory postsynaptic potentials. And therefore, if a different presynaptic neuron is creating an IPSP, an IPSP can undo an EPSP. This is part of integration, right? It's part of counting the votes, really, is what's happening here. So that's why you have it. Well, summation is what I'm talking about when I use the analogy counting the votes. In slide 25, we can see that there are two types of summation. Temporal summation, meaning summation in time, and spatial summation, summation in space. Okay? In both cases, you can have a postsynaptic neuron firing or not, right? Any postsynaptic neuron is going to either fire or not, depending on whether its trigger zone comes to threshold. But in temporal summation, notice what's happening. Even though there are three presynaptic neurons simultaneously synapsing with the postsynaptic neuron, only one of those presynaptic neurons is firing. Notice the red lines. But it's not firing just a single train of action potentials, but multiple trains of action potentials. It's multiple nerve signals that are spaced out in time. There is a certain frequency, in other words. So a single excitatory postsynaptic potential, which is what one of these red lines would cause in the postsynaptic neuron, is depolarizing, but not sufficiently so to get it up to threshold. So one tick mark would not cause an action potential in the postsynaptic neuron. But if they're spaced in time close together enough, then the second one coming along can actually, if it comes along before the first one dies back down all the way to resting, then it will add up, right? Because it doesn't have as far to go. When it doesn't come all the way back down to resting potential, the next one will add up, and it'll keep adding up until it finally gets to threshold. Then you have an action potential in the postsynaptic neuron. That's temporal summation. Spatial summation refers to more than one of the presynaptic neurons firing. Each of their individual EPSPs would be insufficient. But when you have two of them happening at different dendrites on the same postsynaptic neuron, they add up at the trigger zone into a bigger graded potential, and one that might actually bring it up to threshold. So since that's summation at different points on the same postsynaptic neuron, it's spatial summation rather than temporal summation. It's not the frequency from one presynaptic neuron, it's the multitude of presynaptic neurons firing. But in both cases, it's summation. Well, slide 26 shows you in slide form what I was just trying to do with my hands. Each one of these little bumps is in response to a single EPSP, which by itself is not enough. But if the stimulus comes along frequently enough, then they will add up and you will come to threshold. That is temporal summation. What we have in 27 is, first of all, I hope you recognize that this is an axoaxonic synapse, right? Because the gray axon terminal is synapsing with a second neuron's axon. Well, the orange axon is, of course, going to release neurotransmitter if it fires. So if an action potential is created here at the end of the orange one, then it will release neurotransmitters, which have whatever effect they have on the one beyond it. If the gray one, which is an inhibitory neuron, that's why it's labeled as I, if it's not firing, then it's the same as if it's not even there, right? And therefore, an action potential that got started at the other end of the orange one gets propagated all the way to the end, and it will release neurotransmitter. On the other hand, if the inhibitory neuron fires, then the release of its own neurotransmitters onto the axon of the original one is going to hyperpolarize that membrane, and therefore it will stop an action potential from creating another one next to it. So the original neuron got stimulated, and the action potential would normally be propagated all the way to the end, but because of the neurotransmitters from the inhibitory neuron, it gets stopped before it actually reaches the end, and therefore no neurotransmitter is released from the original neuron. So one neuron is keeping another neuron from firing all the way, basically. That's why it's called an inhibitory neuron. So this is part of how integration works. Things happen the way they do because of a bunch of inputs. I have to stop there.